From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. Back in 2023, a group of scientists and activists published a warning that the Great Salt Lake might disappear in as little as 5 years. And that didn't turn out to be anything close to what happened. And last week on this program, we discussed why it was possible that those warnings could have been correct, but that it was also very unlikely. You don't need to have listened to last week's episode to understand this one, but it might help. And like every edition of this show, you can find that episode at upr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we're going to build on that conversation by talking about how chaos and probability fit into predictions like that infamous 5-year warning. Joining me to talk about this today is Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio reporter Clarissa Casper. She and I have been working together for several months now on a series in the Tribune called The Seagull and the Snowpocalypse. You can find that online now. Hey, Clarissa, welcome back.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
And joining us once again this week is Undisciplined producer and frequent guest host, Reagan Edelman. Hey, Reagan.
Hey, Matthew. Hey, Clarissa.
Hey, my mom likes it better when you guest host.
That's the nicest thing that I've ever heard.
When we left off in the last episode, Reagan, you were asking about a snowstorm that hit right as the 5-year report was issued.
Right. I was wondering why they couldn't have seen it coming. I mean, didn't the weather reports indicate that January was going to be pretty stormy and snowy?
Okay, and moreover, Reagan, actually, December had been pretty snowy too. November and December of that year had been relatively snowy too. But we got to remember here, like, the difference between weather and climate, right? Climate is based on long-term averages. Weather can change from day to day. So, like, one big snowstorm or even one big month, like January 2023 was, that alone is not going to change the trajectory of the lake. And that is, at the time, like, as of the morning of January 4, absolutely, we knew that there was a snowstorm on its way to Utah that day. And we knew there was another one behind that. We can predict weather pretty effectively, pretty skillfully. That's the word that meteorologists and climatologists use, you know, 5 to 10 days out. So we can only measure climate based on historical records, what happened year after year, season after season, decade after decade, and so on. Okay, that's how we know what a climate is. Climate changes very slowly over time. So past 10 days, if we're trying to predict the weather, really the best you're going to do is to look at last year's weather on that same date and say that was the weather last year on that same date. And you're going to be just as accurate in predicting weather as you would if you were looking at the global picture, the radar picture. So the thing that we can do, though, is we can say, okay, what is happening thematically in the world right now? And that is to say, like, are the oceans warmer in this area and colder in this area right now? Right. So we can look, like, really more broadly at things that are happening across large global scales. And then we can say, in the past, what has happened when that happened? What does that mean for the Mountain West?
And we do that by looking at something called the North American Multi-Model Ensemble.
So the NMME isn't a singular model. We call it a model, but it's actually an ensemble, right? The North American Multi-Model Ensemble. And it's a bunch of different models. And Clarissa, you talked to Ben Kirtman about this, and he explained, this is the guy who created the NMME. And he explained to you something about these models, yeah?
Yeah. He kind of explained that these models, they're very accurate in some places in the world, and they're less accurate in other places.
As our science, as the science of climate prediction matures, it's becoming increasingly clear that all of our tools are seriously flawed, but they're all flawed in unique ways. And so what a multi-model system does is it takes advantage of the fact that, you know, one model's good in this direction, another model not so good. And so you take advantage of the strengths of certain models and you're able to discount the weaknesses. It's a way of judicious cancellation of errors. So it's a little bit like having lots of voices in the room when you have to make a tough decision. Right? You want all points of view.
In the Southeast, where he works, he's a researcher at the University of Miami. The model is pretty skillful at predicting fall and winter rainfall, and it's gotten better over time on predicting winter conditions in the broader south, as well as precipitation in the Pacific Northwest. But he talked to me that there is a place in the world where the model doesn't work very well, and it happens to be the region surrounding the Great Salt Lake.
So this model has this gap, and it's right in the area where the Great Salt Lake happens to sit. Why? What's so different about the Great Salt Lake that it's harder to predict?
There are two main reasons why the Great Salt Lake is a hard area to predict in. One of the first is the influence of atmospheric rivers in the area. So atmospheric rivers are these long plumes of concentrated moisture in the sky. Basically, think of a river in the sky. They come from the tropics and they flow across the ocean and they come here to the Rocky Mountain Range. And some researchers, such as the guy I talked to, Joseph Clark, he studies seasonal predictability of these rivers for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He said he believes that these atmospheric rivers have been intensifying with climate change, and they will probably continue to do so.
Okay, so a river, though, has riverbanks and typically stays within the same area for the entirety of its existence. Even if it ebbs and flows with how much water is there, the bank is the bank.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up riverbanks, because atmospheric rivers, they don't have riverbanks. So as they get bigger and bigger, it's harder and harder to predict where they're going, because they can meander more and we can't exactly predict like where they're going to dump that water that we talked about.
That's what happened in 2023. A ton of atmospheric rivers just happened to situate so that they came over California, Nevada, and Utah. That was a big part of why we had so much snow in 2023. So that's one challenge, is you just can't predict that. You don't know, because there's no riverbanks. You don't know where these things are going to go. And then there's another problem.
What's the second problem? I'm on the edge of my seat.
So a persistent El Nino, which is warmer waters in the Pacific, in the tropical Pacific, have historically been strongly predictive of colder and wetter winters in the Southwest.
So the Southwest, that's like Arizona, New Mexico, that right. Area. Okay.
Yeah. And then a persistent La Nina can often indicate cold and wet winters coming to the Northwest. You can predict winters better in these areas because of ocean temperatures. But sitting between the Northwest and the Southwest is a band of states, including Utah, where you can't predict what's going to happen that winter based off the ocean temperature like you can in other places.
So we've got unpredictable atmospheric rivers, which are responsible for big winters like the winter of 2023. And then we also have unpredictable connections with ocean temperatures, where sometimes a really, really big La Nina might result in that cold and wet winter that's in the Northwest kind of like floating over toward Utah, or a really, really big El Nino might result in that, you know, colder and wetter winter in the Southwest floating up toward Utah.
Right. And we've had both, right?
And we've had both. If you look at past La Ninas, some La Ninas, we have huge winters in Utah and sometimes we have droughts. And you look at past El Ninos and sometimes we have huge winters in Utah and sometimes we have droughts. So this thing that all of our friends and all of these other states kind of around us can use to better predict their winters, we can't.
That's what an atmospheric scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles, Siyu Zhao, told me. He was the lead author of a 2021 study that showed large uncertainties in models that have attempted to identify this connection.
And what we probably should say here is that there aren't a ton of studies that are very specific to modeling precipitation that falls in the Great Salt Lake basins directly. But there is lots of data showing that there is a strong and pretty sensical correlation between precipitation in the upper Colorado basin and the neighboring basins of the Great Salt Lake. When you get lots of snow in one of these areas, you get lots of snow in the other.
So I'm not sure about the Great Salt Lake, but I think it's pretty close to the Upper Colorado River Basin. So, and I think the circulation pattern, and I think it should be very similar. So I have never looked at into this region, but if I compute the correlation between the tropic ocean and the stream flow or precipitation in the Great Salt Lake region, I think there may be some correlation. I think all the climate models, they show different deals on this kind of thing. So there should be some uncertainty on it, and so it's hard to say we can truly have a very decent prediction skills.
Hey, Undisciplined listeners, you're listening to part two of our series, which was done in collaboration with the Salt Lake Tribune, on how a very popular report that warned that the Great Salt Lake might dry up in as little as 5 years came to happen, and why that really dire prediction didn't end up being correct. Clarissa Casper was the lead reporter on this story, and if you appreciate her work, as I do, you can contribute to her efforts and the efforts of all the journalists at the Salt Lake Tribune by going to sltrib.com, clicking on the donate button, and using the code GSL for a discount subscription. So winters in the region that fills up the Great Salt Lake are stochastic. That's a fancy word meaning the patterns of the weather are subject to lots and lots of unseen and random oceanic and atmospheric influences.
So what are the factors then that actually go into this? We can't predict it because of all of these moving pieces. We can't use the same factors that people have used in other regions. What can we do? What all is congregating to cause this?
Butterflies.
And seagulls.
Butterflies and seagulls? Like the insect and the bird?
Yeah.
Is this a metaphor?
Yeah, it's a really old metaphor. It comes from this guy, Ed Lorenz. Ed Lorenz was a meteorologist and mathematician in the middle part of the last century, and he gave a talk at a scientific conference in Washington, D.C. in 1972. And in that talk, he came up with this metaphor for how chaos impacts the atmosphere and our ability to predict weather and climate. And he asked this question. He said, does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas? You guys have heard this idea before, right?
Right. In Ed Lorenz's first writings of this concept of the butterfly effect, he used to use a different animal, though, to make his point. And he would say, one flap of a seagull's wings would be enough to alter the course of weather forever.
Ed used Utah State bird.
Yeah, and one of Great Salt Lake's birds, too.
This is kind of the basis of chaos theory, too, no? Where each individual condition plays a role in everything else. So if one thing's shifted, then everything's shifted.
Right, which is what makes prediction, atmospheric prediction, very hard, is because there are so many factors at play at any one time that you can never identify a causal factor. And even if you do, like, let's say you identify, like, ooh, this one butterfly's wings had an effect. Well, now you have to account for all of the other butterfly wings, too. You'll never be able to perfectly predict all of the factors that go into making weather and making climate.
So in other words, there is no way that the people who wrote this report that was released in January 2023, or there was no way anyone, for that matter, could have possibly predicted this snowpocalypse that came upon us.
Yeah, that sort of lets them off the hook in a little way, right? Because they saw this trajectory. They saw that this thing was really bad. It had been bad for several years. And they were like, if this continues for 5 more years, the lake is going to be gone. And there was no way that we could have said in any meteorological model or a seasonal model like the NMME or a long-term model what was going to happen. There was no way we could have told them, like, no, that's not going to happen. But there's also something else that was true at this time. And this is important here when we're talking about this 5-year report and, you know, the real fear that it stoked in a lot of people, because there was actually no evidence that 2023 was going to be another devastatingly bad water year either.
Wait. But what about these trends that we were talking about earlier when they looked at the chart that they had made based on recent years? It was on that downward trajectory. That's the whole reason they were able to get that 5 years number.
Yeah. So do you remember when we were talking about the SPI 9, the measure for drought, and we were talking about the D1, D2, D3, D4? So let's talk about similar periods of time in the past in which we have had a pronounced period of drought. If you were to look at a time series of drought in the basins that fill the Great Salt Lake, what you would see is that occasionally you will have these really intense periods of drought where we get into that D4 territory. And so, like, one happened, you know, in the years right before this report was issued. And then you can go back like another, I don't know, like 10 years about, and you see kind of another one. And you go back another about 10 years and there's another one. All of these periods, though, they all last about a year or 2 years. They don't last a whole lot longer than that. But these periods of acute, intense drought come and go, and they've been coming and going for as long as we've been measuring precipitation in the Great Salt Lake Valley. And they don't last 5 years. And in fact, they don't last 8 years, which is the amount of time that they would need to last in order for the conditions that these scientists made their calculations in to continue onward. Because it would have been 3 years of drought until they wrote the report, and then 5 more years after that. So that would have been an 8-year acute drought. And it's just never happened before.
So this trend just didn't take any of that into account.
They were not wrong when they said if the Great Salt Lake continued to lose 1.2 million acre feet of water for the next 5 years, that the lake would disappear. That's just simple math. What they either didn't take into account or they didn't communicate adequately was that the likelihood that this would continue was not great. That we were not likely to stay in this state of intense, intense drought for a very long time.
Hey, but what about climate change? Climate change is what we've been focusing this show on, first of all, for the past several months.
To the chagrin of many of our listeners who want us to talk about something else.
And if we've learned anything, it's that it's very, very real. So these previous patterns might not actually be pertinent. They might have been onto something, no? Like, everything seems to be getting a little bit worse.
Yeah, but climate change happens in fractions, not factors. You don't really see it happening.
Give me more. Fractions, not factors. I want an example.
So it can kind of be related to falling out of love with somebody. At first, you love them a lot and you don't see anything wrong with them. But the longer you're with them, maybe there's something that bugs them that you find okay at first. But then there's more and more. And as the longer you're with them, the more things you find that you don't really like about them. And then you end up breaking up and it's this big thing. But it's happened for a long period of time.
All of these little pieces over time come together to cause these problems.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so sad.
It is a sad metaphor.
Okay, but that's really good, though. That's a really good metaphor, because basically what it says is, like, those little things you might not notice along the way. They accumulate over time.
Right. And you think about it, like, this summer we've been hearing record-breaking temperatures a lot. But if you look at those temperatures, they're only, like, slightly higher than the last record-setting temperature.
You guys know what another good metaphor for this is? Is the Olympics.
To complete the set, this for the world record. Yes! Magnificent!
Like, there were a bunch of records broken in the recent Olympics. Nobody pole vaulted twice as high as the last record setter. And nobody ran the 100-meter dash 4 seconds less than the last person who ran the 100-meter dash. That doesn't happen. It happens in very small increments.
And based on all of this data that you're talking about and the historical trends, obviously climate is so hard to predict. It's what we've been talking about this whole episode. But it's not that far off base to say that we were almost overdue for some much needed moisture. And obviously overdue is the wrong word, but it was bound to happen eventually if we were following trends in previous years, even with those fractions of climate change.
Yeah, so let's use another metaphor here. It's like flipping a coin. So you might flip one coin and it's heads, and you flip another coin and it's heads, and you flip another coin and guess what? It's heads again. What's the next flip likely to be?
It's likely to be tails.
No, it's likely to be heads or tails. It's still 50%. That's how probability works, right? I know. It feels like it's likely to be tails, but at every single flip, it's still 50%. The probability of that flip does not change based on the past outcomes. And so remember our conversation about the NMME, which is like it doesn't do a very good job of predicting what's going to happen in this liminal band of states that includes the Great Salt Lake's watershed. But we can think about like climate change like that. Like, let's say we put a little tiny piece of lead on a quarter and we put it on the head side so that that's weightier. So like tails is more likely, right? We're still not always going to get tails. It just makes it a little more likely. That's what climate change is doing. It's making things a little more likely. So it's not a 50% coin flip. It's 51, it's 52, it's 53, maybe it's 60. Maybe climate change is putting that kind of pressure on it, but still we're flipping the coin every winter, what kind of winter we're going to have. And having 8 flips in a row. You guys have coins on you right now?
I have a penny.
Okay, Reagan, let's say 8 winters at 50% per winter. Okay. So we're going to get 8 tails in a row or 8 heads in a row. Which one do you want?
I'm going to go with heads.
Okay. Flip your penny.
Heads.
Okay. That's 1. Flip it again.
Heads.
That's 2. We're 2 of 8 into it. Go again.
Heads.
Yeah. And you're like, oh my gosh. Right. But still, it feels like tails is due, but the probability still says 50-50. Okay. Flip again.
It's heads.
That's 4. You get 4 more heads?
I got my tails.
You got your tails on your 5th flip.
It was that flap of the seagull's wings.
That's right. The probability of obtaining 8 heads in a row when flipping a coin is 0.00391.
So there have been changes, though. Craig Miller, he's the hydrology and modeling manager for the Utah Division of Water Resources. He said that historically, the state would get good water years following good water years and dry years following dry years. And we would often get lots of winters year after year where we get lots and lots of snow.
You know, back in the 80s, we had good years following good years, and that really fills in the lake.
There's still occasionally like 2 of the top 10 water years on record for Salt Lake City came in the last decade and a half. They just weren't followed by another huge water year.
Yeah. So we're still getting them, which is good, but they're just not as consistent as they used to be.
And so this idea that we were going to have 8 really bad years in a row was unlikely. As we were preparing this series, we kept saying that hindsight is 20/20. And that bears mentioning here too. In all of our reporting, we never came upon any indication that the writers of the report that said the Salt Lake could dry up in 5 years had anything but the best of intentions in sharing that information. And we do know now that it was possible in early 2023 that we could be in for 5 more years of exceptional drought. But we also know that, historically speaking, it was exceptionally unlikely, even under climate warming. Should that have been part of the report and the reporting on the report that came in the media afterwards? And what would have happened if it was? Well, those are the questions that Clarissa, Reagan, and I are going to be grappling with in the 3rd and final episode of this series. Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. This episode is based on a 3-part series, The Seagull and the Snowpocalypse, in the Salt Lake Tribune. The Tribune is a nonprofit news organization that depends on your support too. You can back its important work at saltlaketribune.fundjournalism.org. The Siegel and the Snowpocalypse is a project of concurrent scientific and journalistic exploration using the research-based reporting framework. That means that I am a co-author of both this series and a peer-reviewed study backing some of this reporting. That study is called A Nuclear Bomb or Just a Joke? Groundwater Models May Help Communicate Nuanced Risks to the Great Salt Lake. And it was published in the journal Water in August of 2024. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.